Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The first measure taken by the village authorities who were party to the demolition project was cutting off water and electricity supplies to homes. Then, they sent thugs to spray paint our houses with intimidating words, "If you refuse to move, the house will be bulldozed while you're asleep, and those who don't vacate, watch out for your safety." Both threats were carried out. Some villagers find their homes bulldozed in the middle of the night. Others were bitten. At night, they drove trucks through the paddies and farms, destroying our crops and vegetables, killed our poultry, and fed our dogs poison. They set fire to my courtyard, built with teak wood in the 19th century. 4 generations of my family have lived in this traditional home. My life was spared only because I wasn't at home at the time. Those of us who submitted a petition letter were particularly targeted. My eldest daughter, who was one of the petition organizers, was badly bitten by a bunch of thugs when she returned home from work late at night. She was left unconscious, lamented another interviewee.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, chair of the Economics Department at the University of San Francisco. My guest today is Lynette Ong, a professor of political science at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. Lynette is one of the leading experts on the political economy of development in China. Today we'll be talking about her third book, Outsourcing Repression, Everyday State Power in Contemporary China. Lynette, welcome.
Hello, Peter.
So we opened with an excerpt from your book with quotes from some of the people that you spoke to in the course of your research. But let's talk more about that kind of incident. So first of all, there are these thugs, you know, abusing ordinary citizens. What was their objective? What were the thugs trying to get the people to do?
So these thugs were, you know, street hoodlums and gangsters. They are not particularly well organized individuals, not well trained to conduct violence. These are individuals who are usually unemployed. They are mobilized by some contractors or local governments to conduct a project. Their purpose is really to execute low-level violence in order to impose compliance on recalcitrant citizens, to get them to do something they would not otherwise do so by imposing usually low-level violence. So from intimidation, spray-painting people's houses, cutting off utility supplies is almost like the default positions. And when those strategies are not successful, they will go on to, you know, intimidation and then beating people up, possibly as the most violent strategy.
And they're trying to get people to move out of their homes?
They are trying to get people to move out of their homes, to give up their land. Sometimes, you know, if the government cannot produce proper papers to show that this is a legal procedure, if the procedures are not followed properly, you can imagine peasants and residents do not want to comply with government policies. They are also being deployed sometimes to deal with petitioners. So the second quotation is about how thugs were deployed to beat up petition organizers.
Yeah, so let's talk about each of those phenomena in turn. So those aren't the central topic of your book, because they're well known to people working on China. But First of all, why is there such an issue around land ownership and moving people off of land in China over the past few decades?
So when at the beginning of, this is about 10 years ago, so when Li Keqiang first came to power, he actually explicitly articulated that China is going to promote urbanization, not only because you know they want to move people around, but because as an engine of growth, because urbanization involves construction, and construction activities would create jobs and create and has spillover effects over services sector. So that is very much seen as a growth engine, and local officials are evaluated on a bunch of criteria that are related to GDP attainment. So people, you know, officials out there would put all their resources into grabbing land, demolishing houses, just to create the buzz around urbanization and its related economic activities, because this is how they are evaluated.
Okay, so local officials are induced to promote development, and not just development generically, but a specific model of development that involves lots of infrastructure and housing construction, sort of in some cases, even if there's not immediate demand for it, but just like to create activity, moving people off the land and converting small rural villages into dense modern
houses. Yes. Okay. So, you know, that's the rationale behind why urbanization and the sort of strategies, outsourcing repression type of strategies that I described in the book are so prevalent. But the logic of exercising state power, that sort of strategies could actually be found throughout a bunch of other policies, such as collection of illegal taxes, the fee for exceeding the one-child policy, for breaking the one-child policy, and more recently to zero COVID. We have seen it on social media, similar strategies of deploying thugs, deploying gangsters, as well as deploying brokers, which is the second part of my book, the focus shifted to nonviolent strategies. Those things could be seen in other areas too.
Yeah, so explain more about the non-governmental thugs, you know, because as everyone knows, China has an authoritarian government, and any American who knows a little bit about Chinese politics probably has images in their head of, you know, tanks driving through Beijing toward Tiananmen Square. So, like, if this is a country that can deploy tanks against its people, why doesn't it just have the police or the military move people off land when they want them to move off land? Why do they have to go and use these kind of untrained, undisciplined thugs?
That's a great question. I think when we think about violent repression, there are two dimensions to it. It is usually, in Western concept, an ex post measure. So when there's a large protest or collective action, the state might send in the military or sometimes the police to arrest people, to put down protesters. But I think deploying informal thugs, right, the social actors, non-state actors, is intended or designed to be a preemptive approach. So they go intimidate people and deal with people before protests break out, right? So if the government has some information about people are trying to organize or people have been resisting in certain areas, they're trying to hire low-level violence, third-party agent to preempt the formation of collective action. That's one dimension. The other dimension is I think, by outsourcing violence, by outsourcing particularly violent repression to someone else, it's a way of getting things done while not hurting your legitimacy all that much. So it's a pretty smart strategy. It has some analogy to a recent book called Spin Dictators, where you know dictators. We know that dictators they want to be loved and feared. They want to impose their compliance on the citizens. But if they impose too much repression, they'll get resistance. And outsourcing repression, I think the beauty of that is it is able to address the trade-off between the two, to the extent that the state can then impose its compliance on the one hand and minimizing resistance and the backlash on the other hand. So they could actually have the best of both worlds.
Right. Yeah. So I actually had Dan Treisman on the show a little while back for his book Spin Dictators with Sergei Guriev. And they look around the world, and they sort of document a shift from authoritarian governments that just kind of tell people what to do and, you know, bash heads together until people do it if necessary, a more modern version where they try to manipulate the information environment, not just through like old-fashioned propaganda, but through social media and other more subtle censorship of the news to get people to actually think that something, some version of like, despite its faults, this is the best government we could possibly have, so we really should support it. And so you're saying that the Thugs for Hire kind of fits into that framework as well.
One of the strategies, or one of the main takeaway points of the book, is that there's an increasing trend of authoritarian governments camouflaging violent repression, which would usually discredit the dictator, right? But so my argument is that by outsourcing repression, by camouflaging violent repression, by getting third-party non-state actors to do it, they can actually, it wouldn't usually discredit the dictators if there's no agency problem. If excessive violence were used, then they will be agency problem. But in chapter 3, I looked at a bunch of cases, 2,000 cases from a collection of data set that I have built. On average, when thugs were deployed, even though they were more likely to do violent jobs, the likelihood of provoking violent and non-violent actions from citizens is usually negative or very low.
So most of the time they can be sent out, and once people realize that they're there, they'll go along with whatever the orders are. But don't they still realize that ultimately these guys must be coming from, even if they're not wearing uniforms, they must be from the government?
Yes, I think, the people have some ideas that they have some sort of association with the government. But the fact that they are not wearing uniform and their non-state identity also provides the state the opportunity for plausible deniability. They can turn around and say that, I did not do that, and they can escape responsibility.
Is there an element also of deniability, maybe upwards? Like if I'm a local, mayor, and I want people to move out of some area, I don't actually have control of the military, just the way China's structured, but I do have control of the local police. So I could send in the police maybe, but then maybe I wouldn't actually want to tell the provincial government, like, yes, I went in and, shot a bunch of people or fomented a riot to do this housing development. Whereas if it's just these anonymous thugs, I can say, oh, well, the property developer, because there is a property developer involved as well, usually, right? It's sort of a collaboration between the local state, the property developer. I can kind of blame them and say, oh my goodness, I had no idea that they were behaving so badly. And that, and I can tell that story both sort of downward to citizens and also upward to my superiors.
Yeah, so the accountability goes both ways. So if a case involves excessive violence, if there's agency problem involved, right? So people could take a snapshot of the violent incidents and upload it to social media. That would, of course, hurt the local government's legitimacy in the eyes of the citizens. That's downward accountability. But if it gets excessive, and it will also put the central government or provincial government in trouble, right? Because they are ultimately accountable to someone higher up. So eventually, it has happened in the case studies that I described in Chapter 4. Some municipal government has use excessive violence, then the provincial government eventually stepped in because it put them in a very bad light too. They have to fire the municipal governor. In this case, there is some sort of upward accountability. So it exercises that in both directions.
Right, because in a sense, the higher levels, they also may or may not actually care whether violence is used, but they don't want to be associated or sort of tainted.
So if the violence is not excessive, they will usually close one eye, because the root cause of using of using third-party outsourced violence is because there's a lot of unfunded mandates, right? After 94, fiscal re-centralization, local governments have a lot of expenditures, but not enough revenue because a lot of revenues have been re-centralized to the central government. This is a perennial problem in Chinese politics. So, you know, they would close one eye as long as things are done. But if you get into too much of a trouble, if there's expose on social media, you eventually get me into trouble too. Then I have to step in and then fire you.
Right. And just to make sure I'm getting all the links. So this change from the 1990s in the taxation system in China meant that, I mean, first of all, there's no such thing as a local government tax, right? You can't really just, you know, in San Francisco where I live, you know, we're always voting about, should we have another tax on this? Should we tax the rich people? Should we tax the homeowners? Should we tax whoever? Have a sales tax? And local governments can't do that in China, but they're still told by the central government they need to spend more money on schools or sanitation or healthcare or whatever.
So they are actually taxes. They are value-added tax, business tax, personal income tax, agricultural tax, which were abolished 15 years ago, and a bunch of smaller taxes. So even though they are kind of 5, 7, 10 different type of taxes, they have been gradually re-centralized from 94 onwards, divided into various stages. So over the last 2-3 decades, increasing number sources of revenue that used to belong to the local governments have been re-centralized to the central level.
Right. So in a federalist system, we could like decide on local taxes, but in China, what the taxes are is basically decided at very high levels. And then moreover, they decide, here's how much of your local taxes you're going to get back, which could in some cases be a subsidy, but it sounds like quite often is not enough to cover the expenses.
Correct. So China, in terms of its fiscal arrangement, has a decentralized structure, right? But in terms of political evaluation, it's still very much a centralized structure. And there's a tension between the two, too, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they have to provide public goods and services. There's unfunded mandates. They don't have sufficient expenditures. But on the other hand, you are still evaluated by people at the top, right? Even though you're not given sufficient resources, which is part of the problem of partially reformed economy.
Right. And so then this is part of why there's such a huge issue with land. So it's not just about sort of the economic growth mandate of local officials, but also this is a way that since they can't actually tax, this is one of the few things they can do that actually generates revenue for the local government. Is that right?
Correct. I think from a political economy perspective, is the imperative to collect revenue and to accumulate revenue that has been driving local government going out there to grab land and to conduct housing demolition. But the strategies that they use, the strategy of outsourcing repression, is actually prevalent throughout a number of issue areas where the government lacks legitimacy in doing what they do, such as collection of illegal taxes and fees. And now with zero COVID, with resistance from citizens, they are hiring people from outside to dress themselves up in white hazmat suits. You know, you see on social media beating people up if they refuse to take COVID tests.
I was thinking about that. I was going to ask you about that. So, but in that case, if you're wearing a white hazmat suit, I mean, doesn't that pretty much, you know, you've pretty much taken on an official identity. I mean, however this person was recruited, you know, if someone says, well, I went to a COVID testing center, or a bunch of people came to my apartment building and said the government has locked this down, and here I am in my hazmat suit, and I'm going to beat you if you try to leave.
Yeah,
it's hard to see the government getting off, you know, without blame for that. There's no sort of third party they could say, oh, you know, there's no developer or other person they could blame. It really is pretty much the government, isn't it?
Sure. So I would think, you know, what are the other options available to local governments who want to administer zero COVID in a violent manner? They could send in a police, someone who actually dressed in uniform. They could send in someone who worked in neighborhood committees who know that this person explicitly is associated with the government. They could send in a thug that doesn't wear a hazmat suit, or they could hire a thug dressed in white hazmat suits. You know, I think given this range of options, someone with an anonymous identity still provides them with some degree of plausible deniability and as well as protection.
Mm-hmm. And so, well, I guess for obviously for the COVID element, that's certainly happening in cities. Getting back to sort of the period that you were researching, is this sort of the same phenomenon throughout China and cities and in countryside, or what kind of variation did you see?
Yeah, so the two strategies that I describe in the book within outsourcing repression is one of outsourcing violence and outsourcing persuasion, which is mobilizing the masses. So this strategy started from Maoist years, what the Chinese would call 做思想工作, right? You send in some sort of social brokers or political brokers, go in there to persuade individuals to comply with state policies. So
let's talk about that second strategy then before we talk about the variation set, because I haven't given you a chance to talk about that. So on the one hand, we have this sort of approach of outsourcing violence to thugs, or outsourcing repression in a violent form to thugs who have some kind of deniability about their connection with the government. But you're saying that another kind of both very old but maybe more prevalent approach that also has this feature of avoiding outright kind of filmable violence is this very old school Maoist thing of what they call thought work, of going in and persuading people. So right. Tell me more about that, how that happens. Who's being persuaded and how?
Right. So thought work, if you put it in social science term, it is really about the state mobilizing a small segment of the society, right? Who are political brokers? These are people who work in neighborhood committees in the cities, or village committees in rural areas, or social brokers, which is the focus of the second part of my book. So these are community volunteers and community enthusiasts. These are the aunties and the uncles, the dama and the dashu that you see in Chinese cities, right? These are retired individuals. Sometimes they have party affiliation, but they are definitely kind of loyal to the party and believe in what the party does. So they are regularly mobilized by the state, paid minimal amount of compensation to carry out persuasion, because these people are deeply embedded within the community. They have been living with people they are trying to persuade for decades.
For something like a redevelopment project, saying you should move to the little apartment on the edge of the city that they've allocated.
So the position is usually framed in this way. It's not framed in the way of you have to comply with the state policies, but is usually framed as, if you don't comply, think about the inconvenience you'll be imposing on your neighbor. His son is trying to get married. They need a new apartment in order to get married, and the government is trying to give that to them now. But your refusal to do so, you are creating convenience for a lot of people, right? So people cave in because of social pressure. And the reason being drawn on is also of social pressure. These people have social prestige, can then draw on their social capital to conduct persuasion. So on the receiving end, people don't feel like this is state repression. But by complying to what social brokers ask them to do, they are in effect complying to state policies.
I feel like in a sense it's kind of still behind it. It's almost like because of the inevitability of the state, the state is going to do some policy and it's not going to like move anyone. For instance, everyone in your community will all be moved at the same time. So if one of you refuses to move, everyone else will be will suffer, and it removes it from being the state decision, but that is the state decision. If they were negotiating with each person one at a time, then you couldn't be blamed for harming your neighbors. But it's because they're sort of saying you as a community are going to get this deal, and if anyone doesn't go with it, then you'll all suffer. That kind of creates an opening for someone to say, hey, I'm just here as your friend, as your auntie, you've known me for years, and this is just what's in everyone's best interest.
Right. No, precisely. So the alternative is that the state will have to send in demolition officers, right, carrying official status to convince people. So if there's resistance, if there's conflict, is a state-society conflict, direct confrontation between the state and citizens. Sometimes it might break out into protests and might result in petition. But if the state mobilizes social actors, especially social volunteers, to do persuasion, the state can actually step back, you know, hide itself behind the curtain and let the social actors do all the job. When there are conflicts, often case in demolition, because these social actors, they're actually incentivized by carers. They are being paid to do that sort of thing. And the more people they persuade, they're getting paid more. So when there are conflicts, it's a society versus society conflict, right? So the state can actually wash its hand in a way that it changes the nature of the conflicts that doesn't implicate itself.
Okay, and so these are the two kind of methods. So one is the thugs for hire, and one is the kind of grannies for hire. And they're both ways to keep the state from being directly implicated in carrying out somewhat unpopular policies. So then I was asking you about what do you see as a sort of a geographic variation or variation over time in the use of these strategies?
Sure. So I started this project back in 2011. So over time, I see this temporal as well as regional variation. In terms of temporal variation, there is increasingly kind of less violence being used over time because the cost of violence being used is increased with the more prevalence of social media and smartphones. The chances of getting local government exposed and subject them to accountability issue has increased. In terms of regional variation, as I moved from western and inland provinces to middle of China and coastal cities in the last couple of years, I also see less and less violence was being deployed. So when I did work in CBD, Shanghai, central business district of Shanghai, in Guangzhou, violence is rarely heard of because people are very savvy, highly educated, metropolitan cities. They'll be very stupid. Local governments will be extremely desperate and extremely stupid to use explicit violence against citizens.
But then that's interesting. So you're saying that with the rise of social media, there's been less violence. On the other hand, you know, the broad brush characterization of the Xi Jinping era has been that it's become more repressive. So how do you reconcile those two things? It sounds like you're saying citizens have more power because they can, you know.
No, those are that is an excellent question. So that is an issue that I tackle in my conclusion. So what has happened in the last couple of years, particularly in Xinjiang and Tibet and Hong Kong, not so much in Han part of China, is that I think there's a reversal of trend or direction. From what you know, the authors of Spin Dictators call, instead of them spinning it, right, which is what I see as the merit of outsourcing repression as a strategy to one of rule by fear. So I think under Xi Jinping, the administration is getting less and less reticent of using explicit violence and explicit repression against the society. Like we have seen in Hong Kong. You know, this is a very interesting trend. I think it's against the strategy of outsourcing repression, which, in my opinion, has helped the CCP grip society and rule society for many decades. So in spite of its success, the CCP under Xi Jinping is actually moving in the other direction, which I think is going to ultimately hurt the party.
But they're becoming less subtle about it and much more direct. Although I did remember in Hong Kong, there maybe this is part of the transition, but during the protests, there were various incidents where the police just kind of stood back and then kind of mysterious thugs would go in and beat people up. So that is kind of still the outsourcing strategy, but maybe I guess, now they've become much more willing to just go ahead and arrest people.
Yeah, so the Yuanlang incident, I would actually describe that as a failed case of outsourcing violence. Because outsourcing violence, usual context in China is you do it 2 a.m. in the morning in the back alley. But in the case of Hong Kong, it was 7 p.m. peak hours traffic in a very busy MTR station, right? So everyone is going to be witnessing that because everyone has smartphones in Hong Kong. They can just send it to the CNN or if not, just upload to Twitter. So I think the strategy there, the intention is actually not to get people to comply or to give up their resistance. The intention is actually to intimidate, explicitly to intimidate, to show that how powerful and how violent we can be. We can actually go hurt you if you don't give up your resistance, your activism.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the trade-off, right? I guess if you only kind of bully specific people to achieve specific ends, then the rest of society doesn't see it, which can be good for maintaining the appearance of legitimacy. But I guess if there's a mass resistance, as there certainly was in Hong Kong with lots and lots of people, then maybe the incentive goes the other way, where you don't want to hide the fact that you're going to put yourself in danger if you get on the street. You want to bring that message home as firmly and directly as possible.
Yeah. So to send out a loud and clear message to the external audience that what you are doing, your activism, carried explicit cost to your bodily harm and to your lives. And I think that message was actually very clear in that Yuanlan incident.
Right. But that does go against what Treisman talks about in his book. And I think part of, there's two audiences that I think he mentions, which also come into play here as well. One is, the message you want to send to your citizens, where on the one hand, beating them up shows that you're powerful. On the other hand, it shows that you have to beat people up because they won't just go along with what you said because it's a good idea. And then also there's the external audience, international audience. And it does seem like there's been, as China under Xi Jinping has become more confident, I guess we could say, there's been less concern for, what the international community or people watching things on CNN might feel about, witnessing violence. We might wag our finger about it or even impose some kind of sanctions, but they don't seem to care as much anymore.
Sure. And I think in everyday outsourcing violence that I talk about in my book, there's actually no foreign audience, right? Because an average foreign person sitting in Toronto or San Francisco usually wouldn't be reading about violent demolition in Zhengzhou, in Shanghai, unless it gets to New York Times, which is very unusual. Maybe once in the last 30 years, there's a self-demolition case in Chengdu, which made it to New York Times. But the sort of explicit violence being used in Hong Kong, in Xinjiang, we read every day in major Western newspaper. So, which is why I think under Xi Jinping in the last couple of years, the regime has really switched its emphasis, how it conducts its repression. It has, totally forget about casting aside the high cost involved of using explicit violence. So it has gone to the other direction, forgetting about its very successful strategy that has served the regime very, very well.
Yeah, I feel like that is for a lot of us who study China, we sort of up until, we've all kind of transitioned to different points, but I feel like in the Hu Jintao era, a lot of it was like, oh, they're actually very smart and very clever about how they're doing this and, maintaining control without being overtly violent. And, I think there's been a shift in the tone of the community of thinking, even if you guys want to stay in power, what you're doing is just not a strategy that's, it's at best a very short-term strategy. And in terms of long-run legitimacy and support of the Chinese people, who care, right? Even if you don't care what foreigners think about you.
Sure. But I think to be fair, there's kind of emerging research that shows who in China actually knows about repression in Xinjiang, because they have so much control over propaganda and information flow, right? You could have very explicit violent repression in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, but what we see is different from what people in China see. So in that sense, they can still have the best of both worlds. Yes, they do not care about what foreign audience think, but domestically, they're still able to control it, and they still actually care about what Chinese citizens think. Chinese citizens living in China, anyway.
Right. Yeah, they absolutely, yeah, they have a lot of control over information, especially about events within China. And then, also on top of that, there's, a sense that the Han Chinese certainly don't identify with, Tibetans and Uyghurs and tend to maybe feel like, just as with, minority racial groups, a lot of places, sometimes the members of the majority feel like, well, they're just getting what they deserve, or they have to be controlled in this way. And, this kind of attitude goes there as well. And even more so when they're getting such a limited information picture of what's happening. So let's shift gears a little bit now and talk in our last few minutes about the research that you did for this book. So tell us, you actually, your background before your PhD was in economic policy and consulting, and your first book was about China's rural debt crisis. So what was the path that brought you to studying thugs and repression, and how did you go about doing this research?
That's a funny question. I'm quite happy to share the journey that I went through to get this book out. So I wanted to study in 2011. My first field site was in Hefei. So I went in, I wanted to study kind of the fiscal motivation behind urbanization. That's a big topic. But, I was on the ground talking to a lot of people, and I was also interviewing people in Chengdu, in various other cities. People keep telling me about thugs, about violence that they have been receiving, about intimidation. And that got me very, very curious, right? And I figured that, that is a big question, big puzzle, big piece of the puzzle within the bigger picture of urbanization. So I took a kind of a very risky move, forget about the fiscal and taxation type of angle that I wanted to focus on and go right into state repression. And very few people study violence, if at all, about contemporary China, let alone in the repression sense. So it took me a long time to kind of to translate what I observe and translate that into academic knowledge and be able to kind of frame it properly in political science terms.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you do the research? Why don't you talk about the combination of quantitative and qualitative work that went into the book?
Yeah, so the book deploys, three empirical strategies. It's based on almost a decade of ethnographic work from 2011 to 2019. Started from Hefei, then went to Chengdu, Kunming, Zhengzhou, Beijing, Tianjin, Shanghai, Guangzhou. Went to a lot of places, but only a couple of cities has allowed me to collect enough data to put together case studies. But other cities that I've been to, like Guangzhou and Tianjin, I've got quotations, sprinkled throughout different parts of the book. Second strategies is I have a team of, researchers who help me collect more than 2,000 demolition and housing and land grab cases from the 80s, from the 90s to 2010s, that help me analyze this at the more macro and everyday level. So if you like, those first two strategies are outcome variable, right? They show you what the outcome is in terms of repression and resistance that it provoked or otherwise. I also did content analysis of government policy documents. These are written by municipal and central government instructing their local officials how demolition should be conducted, whether or not they should be using reward, punishment, carrot sticks, or persuasion. So over time, I find that the frequency of persuasion in terms of frequency of words analysis, that has increased tremendously. And also the frequency of preemptive measures, preemptive repression has increased tremendously relative to ex post measures. So those are kind of input variables. This is what the government intend, but the outcome may or may not differ depending on the area and different time period.
And so what kind of outcome differences did you see?
So in terms of outcome difference were like, the temporal variation that we discussed earlier and regional variation, less violence over time and less violence from rural to urban areas. These are the two major differences.
Okay. Okay. So, you had a lot of experience, doing I mean, not just doing field work, but, you know, definitely on one of the most sensitive topics in China. I know that you mentioned it became a lot harder for you over the course of the Xi era. How do you see that evolving in the future? Do you think you'll be able to go back and ever do any kind of work like this again? Are other people able to? How do things look going forward?
You know, I feel tremendously privileged to be able to do what I have done. I felt very, very, very lucky. Would I go back to China now to do the same work again? No, because I think, you know, calculation of costs and benefits, the calculation is entirely different. I don't need to spell it out explicitly. You know, people know the answer to that question. And I wouldn't encourage anyone to do that in China today. So I see that as the end of an era, as I've used that term somewhere else, you know. And end of an era of certain sort of academic work that could be done on China. So, you know, walking into the third term of Xi Jinping's China, we have to think about different strategies of data collection. People have been scraping data, open source data, but you have to wonder why those data is open source in the first place. So going back to my three empirical strategies, the third strategy of content analysis of government documents is an open source data, because the government wants you to see what they want you to see. So if everyone just look at open source data and nothing else, not cross-checking in other ways because we cannot, I think that must have implications for the direction of China studies. But that sounds like, you know, our very limited options at the moment.
Yeah, it does. It is quite pessimistic. I mean, they do limit what we can see, although, you know, if they... partly, you know, the nature of modern economy and, you know, the social media, there's a lot of things that get out, even although, of course, they're also working hard to censor it as well. But yeah, it's getting very tricky. And even, you know, for people who are doing quantitative research, it's, you know, always been a crucial element that has to, you know, go in and talk to people in the country about, like, how things work, to understand the context of, you know, what, where your data is coming from, and make sure you're interpreting in a way that's fundamentally sensible.
It's like looking for your keys under the lamppost, right? We have very limited view of China, but I think it also encourages people to speculate about China because they just simply do not have data. So, you know, to use that analogy, people might stop searching for keys. They might think, you know, the keys are actually lost elsewhere. In actual case, it might just be in the dark alley.
So we're all just guessing.
Yes, correct. And that is not what we want to do with a rising power, right? I mean, we really need knowledge, explicitly know about what sort of power China is and is becoming. Guesswork is really not conducive to this era of international geopolitics.
Right. Yeah, it's very sensitive times. And yeah, as we try to avoid avoid the conflicts we can and hopefully cooperate where we can, having more mutual understanding is important. So it's really, really unfortunate that it's become so difficult. Well, I guess on that somewhat pessimistic note, we're just about out of time. So I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with me.
Okay. Thank you so much, Peter.